There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riespendel. I'm your host. On today's program, Congress is back. And that means it's time to step up the fight to save the internet and make net neutrality law. I'll be speaking to Tim Carr. He's campaign director for Free Press, a nonpartisan media advocacy group, and part of the Save the Internet Coalition. He's going to tell me about some actions that happened at the end of August and what the fight is going to look like in Washington. You do want to stay tuned. August 30th, while many congresspeople were in their home districts during the August break, citizens in 25 cities across the country took advantage of having their senators at home to encourage their representatives to support internet freedom. Now Congress is back in session and a large telecommunications bill awaits action. That bill could bring about network neutrality, or it could be an enormous handout to the nation's largest telephone companies. Tim Carr's campaign director for Free Press and part of the Save the Internet Coalition. He tells us more about those August 30th actions and what's planned for the fall fight to make network neutrality the law of the land.
In 26 cities across the country, over 2 days, on Wednesday and Thursday, that was August 30th and 31st, where they turned out in droves at their senators' offices. As you know, the month of August is the August recess, so all senators are back in their states, supposedly taking the pulse of their constituents. And we saw this as an important opportunity to actually let senators hear what the real people think. Too often they're subject to the constant onslaught of lobbyists in Washington, and phone and cable lobbyists often dominate the day in D.C. So over August, while they are home, we turned out dozens and dozens, hundreds of people to deliver we have a million petitions, deliver petitions to their senators and make it clear to them that it's in the public interest and it's in their interest as elected representatives to support enforceable net neutrality and oppose Senator Stevens' legislation, which doesn't have strong enough net neutrality language.
And so as part of this campaign, you said you're encouraging the senators to oppose Senator Stevens' legislation. So are you not focusing as much now on trying to get an amendment on it?
Well, no, we actually will oppose it as it's written today. We need to get an amendment written into it. The basic language of the Snow and Dorgan Amendment, which was offered at the committee level in the Senate, as you know, Senator Snow, Olympia Snow, a Republican of Maine, and Byron Dorgan, a Democrat of North Dakota, have offered an amendment that has stronger enforceable language for network neutrality. We are supporting the introduction and passage of an amendment to that bill. But barring that, the bill's a no-go.
And how successful were those various actions?
Very successful. We turned out people in 26 cities. In some cases, as in Minneapolis, Senator Mark Dayton actually showed up and announced his support for network neutrality. We turned out people at Senate offices, 26 cities. They delivered petitions, and by our count today, five senators, as a result of this action, have announced their position in support of network neutrality. And we expect more senators to be coming out in the week ahead. And our objective here is to consolidate enough support in the Senate so that the Senate leadership, Bill Frist, will not put the Stevens bill as it is written onto the floor.
And so how many votes do you need?
Senator Ron Wyden has put a hold on legislation. And in order for the Senate to overcome a hold, they need to mobilize 60 votes against the hold and then to pass the bill. So for us to maintain a hold and prevent the bill from being voted on, we need to mobilize 41 senators. And we're well on the way right now. We have 27, and we hope to have several more in the weeks ahead.
Are these mostly Democrats? Are there some Republicans in there?
Well, it's largely Democrats. There, Olympia Snow is one Republican. James Jeffords of Vermont, an independent, has also come out in support of net neutrality. So we expect as more and more of our elected officials learn about this issue and as more of their constituents, you know, tell them of their concern, there's just a natural flow, natural momentum towards supporting net neutrality. So time is really on our side. Momentum is really on our side. And for us, it's really an effort of public education, is to educate the public about what's been going on in the Senate, to educate them about Senator Stevens' bad bill and the control that the phone and cable lobby have in dictating the agenda in Washington, and to make them stand up and take action, speak up, and let their senators know that they've got to oppose this bill unless we get solid net neutrality language into the legislation.
So how did all these events across the country come into being? How did this get organized?
Well, the SaveTheInternet.com coalition is 750 organizations, and some of the lead groups, including Free Press, my organization, Common Cause, Consumers Union, the U.S. Perks, and Move On, and others, have joined together with their activists to put out alerts. And we went region by region, state by state, and we asked people on the ground whether they would be interested in leading an event. And we had people step forward and volunteer to help organize an event, to actually turn up in front of the Senate's office, set up a podium, hold up signs, deliver speeches, and then ultimately deliver the petitions to the senators' offices. And so, you know, there were several weeks of planning that went into making this happen, and all told, in 26 cities, we had very successful events.
This is a bit of an uphill battle given the millions of dollars that the telecom industry has to spend freely on advertising, on lobbying, and other efforts?
Yeah, I mean, well, this is a classic case of grassroots mobilization. We have a legislative process that's controlled by big money interests. And the large phone and cable companies, and on this issue alone, have spent more than $100 million on lobbyists, on campaign contributions, on these sort of phony think tanks and what are called AstroTurf front groups. They sent hundreds of millions of dollars to try to set the legislative agenda in Washington against this principle of net neutrality. It's a basic principle that ensures freedom of movement for everyone on the internet. And in the past, they have been successful because there hasn't been an effective public outcry against this sort of business as usual in Washington. And because media policy is often very arcane or very technical, many Americans just sort of, you know, they sort of tune out. But we've been very effective on this issue in educating people. There's been a great mobilization online and within the YouTube universe, with MySpace participants, and through a network of grassroots and consumer advocacy coalitions that we've managed to take an issue, network neutrality, that many would consider somewhat arcane, and really put it at the forefront of the policy news in this year. So we've been successful in trying to, through our grassroots mobilizing, trying to change the agenda and trying to really push back at against sort of corporate policy-making practice that has become all too commonplace in Washington, D.C.
Now, did you get a little bit of a lift from John Stewart highlighting Ted Stevens' comments about the tubes?
Well, I mean, it's been amazing the way the Internet has really... I mean, obviously, this is an issue that deals with the Internet, but the Internet, to my memory, there has been no better case of Internet mobilization around an issue. We have over 6,000 bloggers who are part of this cause, and MySpace has been very active, and YouTube has been a very effective political organizing tool with activists posting videos there. So when something like Ted Stevens' speech gets out onto the Internet, and, you know, before it even got on The Daily Show, you know, there was a prairie fire across the Internet with people sharing videos about Stevens' speech and blogs picking it up. And so it really went stratospheric after it went on The Daily Show. So, yes, those sorts of things help in our public education efforts. They help people realize that oftentimes our politicians aren't working in our best interest and even may not know or understand the issues at play, but are just acting as the errand boys in Ted Stevens' case for big media interests.
Now, the Ted Stevens telecom bill, is this fairly high on the Republican Senate's agenda right now, or is it still hanging kind of by a loose chad down at the bottom?
I would say it's somewhere in the middle. I mean, there are, and Senator Stevens is very engaged in getting it passed, but there are a lot of other issues. Immigration is a high concern. There's some legislation around that, obviously. And, of course, this being a midterm election, many senators are concerned about getting reelected and are trying to play it safe. And when they see that an issue like net neutrality has such broad-based grassroots support, they are very wary about engaging in that issue and may prefer not to have to vote on it, certainly not before the November elections.
And so, aside from Senator Stevens, are there any other really strong supporters of this telecom bill who have the power to kind of bring together a coalition in support of it?
Well, Stevens has really been the most vocal proponent in the Senate. There are supporters in the House. There was a bill that passed through the House, the COPE Act. It was sponsored by Representative Barton of Texas. But there aren't, beyond Stevens, it doesn't really have any strong support, with the exception of a lot of lobbyists in K Street who are doing their utmost to flood Capitol Hill and try to persuade senators to vote for Stevens' bill. And we're constantly fighting against that trend and trying to make sure that the public's voice is heard before K Street.
So what do you think the chances of, one, this bill coming to a vote before election time and of passing the Senate before election time are?
Well, it's really hard to say. I mean, you can never underestimate the power of money in Washington. And the phone and cable companies, again, have committed $100 million to try to gut net neutrality. So as we go into the fall, we go into September and October, I have no doubt that they will be pouring more money into Washington, into ads, into lobbyists, into think tanks and studies to try to push this to a vote in this Congress. So it's hard. I'm not a very good odds maker on this. I know that there is still a fight ahead of us, and we just have to be vigilant at the grassroots level to make sure that the public is as engaged as possible in this issue.
So let's say the Ted Stevens telecom bill passes without any network neutrality additions, or maybe nothing passes at all. Does that mean the net neutrality is dead?
Well, at the moment, net neutrality doesn't exist, and there was an FCC ruling in 2005, a court ruling in 2005, that basically did away with net neutrality, the basic principle that preserved your ability to see, or prevented, actually, the ISPs from discriminating. So if nothing happens net neutrality will not, there is no enforcement for net neutrality right now. There are a few, and this gets a little wonky, but there are a few conditions that are attached to some recent cable mergers that are about to expire, and those FCC conditions mandated that those merged entities observe network neutrality. So without proactive action in Congress, we will lose network neutrality. It doesn't really exist right now, so people need to engage with their senators and get them to proactively include network neutrality language in new legislation.
And
you know, if it doesn't pass in this Congress, we always have the next Congress. We will continue to fight on Capitol Hill, and we will also continue to be vigilant against the large ISPs should they decide to start discriminating and to compromise network neutrality in their services.
And so what things does the Save the Internet Coalition have in store to help push your effort along?
Well, we're going to continue to deliver petitions to senators' offices. We are going to mobilize the 750-plus organizations. These are small businesses and bloggers and consumer advocacy groups to visit their senators in Washington and advocate for us. We're working with a number of organizations. We also have ongoing media strategy. We have a lot of activists who are making videos and PSAs that will be distributed via the web. And if we can raise additional money, we'll also place some PSAs on local broadcasting to try to push back against the telco onslaught, media onslaught. So we have an array of actions planned for the months ahead, and we'll continue to mobilize the grassroots to maximum effect.
And so if I'm listening to this interview right now and I'm interested in trying to help out, I mean, one, what can I do? And two, how might I be able to explain this issue quickly and easily to a friend or a family member?
Well, you can go to savetheinternet.com. We have a list of actions there. There's an act button that's right at the top of the website that lists seven or so actions that you can take, and this ranges from, you know, signing a petition to writing letters to the editor. If you want to explain this issue to others who may not be clear on network neutrality, we also have an FAQ page there that has a series of questions and answers that are helpful in explaining this issue. So the best place to start is at savetheinternet.com. And from there, you can see a whole range of activities that you can take. You know, we also have a map there where you can call your senator and urge them to support network neutrality. So the website is a very good resource for people who are new to the issue or people who are seasoned experts as well.
Okay, Tim. Well, thanks. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Paul.
And that was Tim Carr. He is campaign director for Free Press, talking about what's in store for the fight for network neutrality this fall as Congress gets back into the swing of things, but before those all-important midterm elections coming this November. And, of course, you can get more information at savetheinternet.com as well. Keep checking out Media Geek website at MediaGeek.net. And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. I am Paul Rees-Mundell, and additionally, I am your host. Turn a little bit to some news of our media environment here. In the midst of some CBS affiliates deciding not to air the network's 9/11 documentary that contained some four-letter words spoken by emergency workers while on the job at the Twin Towers, the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit put a hold on an FCC ruling that four other TV broadcasts of profanity violated indecency rules. The FCC ruled as indecent broadcasts on ABC's NYPD Blue, CBS's The Early Show, and the 2003 Billboard Music Awards, although the commission chose not to levy any fines. The four major broadcast networks appealed the ruling, charging that it was unconstitutional, arbitrary, and capricious, and has asked the appeals court to throw them out. Although the FCC issued no fines, the rulings do serve to set precedent on how indecency fines will be judged, and therefore a court finding against the FCC could have a significant impact on how explicit or strict the FCC's indecency standards will have to be. Broadcasters have long complained that the commission's standards on language and content are vague and not well spelled out, and recent decisions have all but eliminated the role of context when it comes to evaluating the F and S words, even when broadcast as mere expletives during live unscripted broadcasts. The court has now ordered the FCC to reconsider the ruling and the broadcaster's argument and respond within 60 days. Interestingly enough, the FCC reported that indecency and obscenity complaints were down sharply in the second quarter of 2006 to 52,067, way down from 275,131 in the first quarter, though it's up slightly from the third quarter of 2005, which saw 44,109 complaints. June saw just 741 complaints, down from 40,000 in May and 11,326 in April. A significant portion of the complaints in April or May were from the American Family Association, which targeted a NASCAR broadcast with an errant swear. And what the FCC is finding, and people who look at FCC records are finding, is that many of these thousands of complaints about indecency and other types of racy content on the airwaves come from the American Family Association, which has a very convenient form on their website to allow people to auto-generate complaints, very often for programming that they've never even seen or was not even aired in their area. So they're complaining that something was profane or offended when they haven't seen it. They just know. It must have been dirty and bad. Turning to media ownership, which is something on the docket at the FCC right now, even though we're not hearing anything from Chairman Kevin Martin. But nevertheless, over 500 people in Milwaukee and Los Angeles turned out during the week of September 4th to voice their frustrations and concerns about the state of their local media and learn more about the ownership regulations the FCC is set to revise this year. On September 4th, nearly 250 people gathered at the University of Southern California at an event organized by the National Latino Media Council. Only the FCC's two Democratic commissioners were in attendance, but they heard plenty of complaints about the lack of local investigative news and the decline of quality in children's programming. Many participants also raised concerns with Spanish language programming that is mostly imported from Mexico and other Latin American countries, with little of it produced locally in the Los Angeles area. The problems are not just with the content, but with the fact that importing programming deprives Los Angeles Latino producers, actors, and writers of valuable employment. In Milwaukee on September 7th, over 300 people brought their concerns about media consolidation to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Again, the only commissioners there were Democrats Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein. Copps told the audience, quote, "Just 4 weeks ago, the Federal Communications Commission announced that it was once again turning its attention to the subject of media ownership and consolidation. Last time they did this 3 years ago, it was a near disaster for America. We can't let that happen again," end quote. More than 80 local residents gave nearly 4 hours of testimony, touching on many aspects of the ownership issue, including how consolidation leads to a reduction in the diversity of voices and viewpoints heard in broadcast media. The Milwaukee event was organized by Free Press, along with a bevy of local and national organizations. The FCC did not officially participate in either the Los Angeles or Milwaukee events, even though FCC Chairman Kevin Martin has promised to hold 7 public fora on the issue. But time is ticking away. The deadline for initial comments to the FCC about media ownership is September 22nd, not very long from now. And we still have yet to see any research from the FCC, research which it has promised, research which is intended to explore and elaborate and give more data on issues like diversity of voices in local markets, how that is affected by ownership, how that might be affected if the FCC gets rid of what's known as the cross-ownership ban and therefore allows TV stations and newspapers to be co-owned, possibly sharing newsrooms. That those pieces of research were very instrumental in the 2003-2004 proceeding that happened. Much of it was pretty specious research. But really, if you want the FCC to pay attention to your comments, it helps for them to be well-informed, be well-reasoned. Certainly, the FCC will listen to the political motions and listen to the fact that thousands and thousands and thousands of comments are being filed saying, please don't further consolidate our media. But the more you can give them great rationalizations, great reasons, great logic about the existence of various qualities of our media and how these things actually happen or really affected, that gives them more arguments to use in making their decision to possibly ward off criticism from Congress and certainly ward off criticism from the broadcast industry, which would be raining holy hell on them if they don't follow their direct orders and commands. Being able to provide really elaborate, very well thought out comments is really necessary to being able to speak out correctly and well, not necessarily correctly, but to be able to speak out articulately to the FCC. But without these, the FCC's research, it's hard to really know what rationales the FCC is actually considering. And furthermore, the FCC has not yet even released what its proposed new regulations would be. So we're really just sort of feeling around in the dark here, really not being given the proper information nor the proper voice as being promised by the FCC that's really necessary but is a very critical issue that affects our everyday life, our everyday information that we get from across our local media. And that's what's happening with the FCC. I'll keep covering it here on Media Geek. Just about to close the show here. Next week, you'll definitely want to tune in. It'll be a highlight on Radio and Revolution in Oaxaca, Mexico. Let me try that one more time. Oaxaca, Mexico. There, the people are starting to take over, and they've taken over lots of local media and have been using radio and television to communicate their own struggles from the streets. I'll be bringing you an interview from two Americans who've been living in Oaxaca, Mexico for the last 7 years, who'll tell us more about what's really going on and what's not being reported at all, really, in the mainstream American news. That's on the next Media Geek. You'll definitely want to tune in. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at radio.mediageek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at mediageek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowe. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WYQZ in Warrenton-Bealeton, Virginia, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.